Welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, joined as always by Rob Wilson, co-founder and CEO of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about agentic AI, and this is the podcast where we explore how intelligence is actually built and where it's going through conversations with the people designing it. Most of what passes as AI strategy these days is really just a buying plan. Organizations pick a few use cases, run vendors through the same checklists that they used for old enterprise software, and then wonder why nobody can say in a single sentence what they're building toward. Underneath the tooling conversation lies the real gap, vision. That's why today we're sharing a conversation with Brian Evergreen, founder of The Future Solving Company and author of Autonomous Transformation. Brian worked on autonomous AI and strategy at scale for Microsoft Research, and he says that the future is created by those who design and solve for it. This starts with articulating a destination so vividly that people can actually see it. Then you build a strategy by working backward and determining what would have to be true in order for the vision to take form. Brian believes knowing what you want your business to be cuts through fear and inertia to reveal where and how AI fits. Bottom line, there's no strategy without vision. Here's our conversation with Brian Evergreen. Brian, it's great to see you again. Last time we spoke, we all agreed that there was a real lack out in the world of a clear strategy, right? For companies and organizations that are approaching agentic AI, there's a glut of tools and information, but piecing it together is quite difficult. So we had challenged ourselves even to in the space of an hour or so, come up with a nice roadmap for organizations to use. When organizations, when business leaders, when executives come to you with questions about agentic AI, what are some of the first things that you tell them that they should be thinking about or looking into?
So it's two part. The first thing I say is, sure, you do need to have some level of literacy of what agentic AI is. How's it different than Gen AI? How's it different than good old fashioned machine learning? So you do need to have that level of literacy. Like, just like if you're a painter, you need to know how to work with colors. Mm-hmm. You need to work with different textures, right? So you need to know what you're working with in the first place. Once you have some level of literacy of what's possible with these new technologies and what they're capable of, the temptation that I would say, you know, that all maybe almost perfectly maps to all the failure percentages we see out there of like 95% of AI projects failing and stuff like that. I'd say that's probably a one-to-one correlation with leaders who go, okay, now I know how this tool works, so let's immediately pick a use case and then let's go. And they essentially have no strategy and no vision, but just a plan, like an agentic AI plan is what I've seen. And it's always well-intentioned by very smart people, right? That's just the way of doing work with it that we've inherited. Mm-hmm. And so what I say instead is the first thing you do is set aside agentic AI or AI, or 5 years ago, I would have said set aside the metaverse or blockchain and just start with what is it that you're trying to do? Like what is the vision that you have for the value that your organization, beyond what you're creating today, new value that you could create? And I would say no strategy without vision. So what is that vision in the first place? Setting everything else aside and forgetting too about this, because if you take the system and the organization as you have it now and say, how do we make it slightly better? That's a very complex question. But if you set the organization and the system aside and say, what would be the most amazing version of what we do if we just forget about all the complexity of what it would take to get there and we just imagine what that should be? And starting from that point and saying, what should that vision be? And then work backwards to figure out, okay, what tools, technologies, processes, et cetera, investments take get from here to there.
I'm kind of hung up on this. Like, I like what you said. I frequently said, like, you don't need a new strategy. You just need to adapt your current strategy.
Yes.
But I like this better. You need to go from a plan to a strategy. I think that's, I like that. I think that's more accurate and say, like, because you have a plan, right? Like your plan is how you buy software today, right? Oh, we need AI software. And then you run it through the same planning system that you have, right? It's not that you don't have a planning system. You have a way to buy software, and you have people who run an RFP, talk to Gartner, create checklists, interview vendors, go through, check the features from the feature list, grab everybody together, and then vote. Like, that's a plan, right? It's a bad plan, but it's a plan. In my opinion, this is what we do for known solutions, for things that we know solve problems, right? The sort of...
If you need a worse WordPress site, that's exactly the process you should follow.
Yep. And then you're like, okay, what about for unknowns? Like, we're exploring for oil versus like tapping oil. Like, what?
Right.
Why doesn't that work?
Yeah. I mean, I think that for one, I'd say that it's unscientific to try to prove in advance when you're doing something truly innovative, because there's no data. Science requires actual data. And so if you wanted to prove something scientifically, you would need data to through experimentation to demonstrate, hey, this is repeated in many different experiments. And so now we know this is real. But we make the mistake when we're trying to be smart, trying to be scientific. We think, well, there's data involved. I'm going to get a bunch of data from, like you mentioned, Gartner or IDC, and I'm going to look at where we think the trends are headed. And then that's what we're going to base our decision on. And unfortunately, that's actually an unscientific way of making decisions, because there is no data about the future. And so you don't actually know where that's going to head. And you, from a systems perspective, there's so many different contexts, tectonic plates that could shift from here to there. And so if you try to go through the traditional RFP process, well, one, you're limiting yourself automatically to vendors who will even bother to participate in your RFP process. And beyond that, you end up with two or maybe three down selected vendors that have done orals that then you have to pick from.
Yeah.
You have to do it. It's sort of like unfortunately, a little bit like our political system, where you end up with a couple down selected that you have to pick from.
It's so funny that you just said that. You just unlocked something for me, because I'm like, there's a vendor, I will not name them, but they get brought up on occasion when we're talking to customers and customers are talking to us. And their approach to building their application is to create a spreadsheet, go through every vendor in the landscape, write down all the features, put a check besides all the features that are most common across all the vendors, have their team build those features into the platform. Like, this is their roadmap, right? Then go to Gartner, who like creates their checklist by doing that exact same thing, looks at them and goes, oh, they check all the boxes, and then they win the deal, because that's how softwares buy, right? And they win and they win and they win because somebody went to Gartner to get the checklist, goes, oh, well, they have all of the checks, and then it doesn't work.
Well, right. And actually, the funny thing about that, like putting it to that layer of abstraction, is something that that bothers me a lot about when people say, well, AI can do this, the job of a financial analyst now, for example, because what they've done is that they've zoomed out to say, analyzing financial data, AI can do that. And so can a financial analyst, same thing. And the same thing, if you look at this feature of these different software vendors, it's like, we might have the same title of a feature, but the actual, what the underlying feature is and the quality is not accounted for in that analysis, right? And I think the same is true when we try to abstract to different task levels and things and say, oh, well, if these are the 10 tasks the average financial analyst does during their day, and we can try to automate those, we think we can do those tasks with AI, then now we can do the job of financial analyst with AI, when that's actually, in practice, just like you said, it's absolutely not true.
This episode is brought to you by OneReach.ai, the runtime for AI agents. Their GSX platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Recently, I worked with the team at OneReach to create an agentic companion for the second edition of Age of Invisible Machines. So now when you scan any of the QR codes found in either edition of the book, an agent is there to provide additional insight using a custom knowledge base. There's also a newsfeed feature with updates on agentic AI, as well as this podcast, and a book resources skill
that provides clickable galleries of footnotes from each chapter, all of it built using the revolutionary Generative Studio X platform. Learn more at onereach.ai.
Yeah, and how crazy is that idea if you really think about checking feature boxes? It's just, it's like entirely the wrong way that this technology works, in the sense that if you want a new feature, like, it can write it during the call. So how does that matter anymore? Like,
well, right.
Like, why does it even matter? Like, you're. Yeah.
Well, it's something that drives me crazy about so many of these, AI, I call them AI influencers, right? And to be as opposed to AI experts, right? And I know there's AI experts who create content, right? But AI influencers who are not experts, you know, to just to distinguish, where they'll do a post and they'll say, well, PowerPoint is dead because this other startup that no one's ever heard of that, you know, created a feature where you can auto-generate slides or something like that. So now this is the end of PowerPoint. And it's like, well, how long would it take like Microsoft to actually recreate that feature? Or they'll say Adobe's dead because of this.
Yes.
Name a huge company. It's a good way to get, you know, views on your post.
Yeah, clickbait crap.
They'll just declare that something's dead when, like you said, like, well, one, sure, maybe AI could even write it even faster. But even if you went through the traditional agile software development and like engineering process, you know, it wouldn't take them long. Maybe a few weeks to rebuild whatever that feature. Like maybe a couple months at most.
Exactly.
The company, like the incumbent company with a massive amount of market share, is not dead just because a new feature came out, right?
Yeah. It's like all software is dead as we know it. So say something interesting. Like, it's all dead as we know it. It's going to change. Now, who's to say that your buddy's company that just made a new version of PowerPoint is going to be the one,
right,
that everyone flocks to when all software is going to change and shift? And, you know, it's, yeah, it is funny.
Talk to me when you have a product that, as I'm giving a speech, is gonna pair an, alongside what I'm saying, bring up the most relevant information based off of like a kind of a RAG application with all of the documents and slides, images that I or anyone in my space has created. Like, now that would be interesting, right?
Yeah, or give me the one that I talk to you, and each person that I'm talking to on a call sees a different slide that's more custom to them and their context, right? Yes. And it's overlaying what I'm saying, and it's like a heads-up display that's like, oh, you don't know what this word means, and it explains it, but then those who do don't. Like, that's, now we're talking the future, right? We're saying, okay, custom decks for each person.
Yes, exactly.
And then most people say, well, that's sci-fi. Like, that's way in the future. And you're like, no, it's what you do now when you go to ChatGPT and ask a question about who the heck is Invisible Machines and why should I watch this podcast? Mm-hmm. And it says, well, based on your history, based on what I know of you, here's why you should watch it. It has a memory.
That's right. Yeah. And hey, you know, you asked about this thing. They actually talked about an episode, blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you're obviously obsessed with Cassie Kosar-Kauf because of all the times you ask about her in ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
On there, what, three times or something like that?
You gotta
go check out episode. Boom, boom, and boom.
Well, and Brian, you mentioned something. You talked about this idea of being connected to sort of like a RAG database or something that could give you information in real time. If we get back to this idea of creating a roadmap for an organization, like, once you have that vision, one thing that Rob and I agree on as a logical first step is beginning to create source of truth for an organization, because for AI agents operating as tools to be able to do things reliably, they need to be able to link into that. And we had a pretty cool conversation with Jeff McMillan and David Wu from Morgan Stanley, and they were actually doing this pre-ChatGPT with OpenAI. They were working directly with Sam Altman and some of the people there. And what they realized is it was obviously a lot more than just a dump of like, here's all our unstructured data, now make us a source of truth. And it became a lot more about like creating this system, right? So all the unstructured data is accounted for, but there's also people assigned to it. Documents are assigned a time to live. So there's a call to come check and make sure that the information is still relevant. If we look back and think about a vision, their vision, I think, was that they wanted to use AI to augment the abilities of their financial advisors so that they could save time, kind of like what you're talking about in the idea of like giving a presentation. They're with a client they can get answers a lot more quickly and stay more in the moment, human to human.
From a vision perspective, what I love about that is that it's visceral. That's something I always tell people when they're trying to come up with a vision, because it's easy to try to think that, oh, that our company is 10%, you know, more profitable is my vision. That's not a vision, right? So vision of like, I want when my financial advisors are in the room with a customer, they can in real time answer all their questions to the maximum amount of information that's available to help them make like solid financial investment decisions. Like, even though that's a little wordy, like it is a vision, right? And you can kind of imagine being in the room. I'm sure there's a way we could word that to be even more visceral. A couple examples I give is like when you think about JFK saying, he could have said, my vision is that we will, by the end of this decade, we will successfully land on the moon and return. Like that's the same vision he articulated, but he didn't articulate that way. He said, we'll successfully land a man on the surface of the moon and return him safely home. And when you hear that, landing a man safely on the moon, you can almost feel the footsteps like landing, right? It's visceral. And the same thing, like when I work with IT departments and I give them examples. I say, for example, what if your IT work in IT was so good that all of your business partners, whenever someone comes to try to sell shadow IT to them, they laughed them out of the room. It was laughable that they would ever work with anyone outside of the scope of IT. Like, go talk to IT. Like, it's ridiculous to think that we would ever do, you know, a shadow IT project, because we love the work from IT so much. So I always say, like, start with an extremely visceral, you could almost feel the emotion of the moment of what it would mean to have gotten there for your vision. It's much easier alignment then. Then once you've done that, then ask the question, what would have to be true for us to achieve this vision, and work backwards from there. And that's something that guidance that precedes me of like what would have to be true. Like Roger Martin, some of the great thinkers have asked that question. Where I would say my most unique contribution in the recent years has been, I have created a framework for turning that strategy of what would have to be true into something that's scientific and visible. So you document all things that would have to be true from where you are to where you want to go in one single view of, these are all the things that if all these things were true, we would have achieved this future. Now, maybe we don't know how that would be true, but it would have to be true that we'd be able to get this information in real time. Yeah. Okay, well, what would have to be true to get that information in near real time? Well, we'd have to have systems that connected to blah, 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 blah. What would have to be true to have that system that connects to there? There'd have to be some kind of commercial incentive for that, right? You know, that regulated authority to be willing to give us that information. Yeah. What would have to be true for that? Well, policymakers would have to, right? Like, you can work backwards. You can actually do strategy in a way that most organizations, their strategies are invisible.
I think of how many times we provide our customer with tools and no vision, which happens, unfortunately, more times than I would like to admit. It's like handing someone those pneumatic air guns, right? And then them taking it and smacking it against the nail, right? And we're like, it hurts me because I invented this thing, to watch them do that, right? And then they're like, what the fuck is wrong with this nail gun of yours? This is the worst hammer I've ever used. And both of us are miserable, right? And the question is like, what would have changed that, right? What would have, and your point is like you, right? Like, why don't you start with, first of all, understanding how to build houses in this new age of pneumatic tools. And then we'll hand you the nail gun before you start hammering, right? There's like, take a second to understand how these tools work and then start hammering. Stop buying stuff. And then realizing like, wait, we bought the thing, like as if implementing an AI strategy is about buying stuff versus like learning stuff.
And I'll go a step further to say, it's also not just about learning stuff, because there's a lot of organizations out there right now that think, okay, if we train everyone in our whole organization how to use Gen AI, you know, then we've introduced our new, you know, our brand name LM, right? Or language model. Or GPT, and then let's train everyone on it. And then adoption becomes the false proxy for success. And adoption is not like, adoption is how you measure if you're like in IT, like, do people like the new tool that we just introduced? Like, that's a good adoption metric. But for whether or not your company's getting value out of a Gen AI system, adoption is absolutely the wrong metric. I made a joke recently about like someone coming up to Darth Vader and saying, like, Lord Vader, we've reached 99% adoption of our new platform. And then him saying, great, so have you found the rebel, like the Rebel Alliance? And it's like this awkward pause and like, no, we haven't. And then it's like, but Jeff in accounting said that he's like much more efficient now. And then like, you know, like asterisks, like, you know, the rest is cut off due to graphic content, right? So I think we look at Gen AI and people look at adoption. There's people building up cottage industries, training people. And the example I gave, I love that you use a construction example, Rob, because my dad actually was a general contractor. So I grew up with a tool belt around my waist, and I use tons of construction examples. And the one here for adoption is like, if you wanted Duomo in Italy, right? Mm-hmm. In Florence, this big, beautiful building, they weren't even sure if they could do it, right? You wouldn't get there by training everyone in Florence how to use hammers and nails and then wait for like some bottoms up innovation. No, training everyone in hammers and nails in Florence might've meant people are going to build slightly more robust or like stable homes, or they're going to be able to fix them mm-hmm. on their own. There is a value there. There is, but it's, you're never going to get Duomo from mass of tools.
I really like prediction machines for this. Microeconomics of Artificial Intelligence by Joshua Gans. It's kind of like an evolution of prediction machines, but it really gets into like the weeds, and it doubles down on this idea that what you're saying, there's point solution change, which is like incremental improvement that AI can bring to like the way you do things. And you should not mm-hmm. forsake that. Like, go ahead, get those gains, but just do what you normally do. Evaluate short term, look at ROI, like don't make long contracts. And sure, if that just, you know, gives you a 10% efficiency lift in area X, like, of course do that, but it doesn't, but that's not the strategy. That's the plan. Right. Over here, while doing that, there's a top-down right. strategy. Let's call that the bottoms-up strategy. Over here, there's a top-down mm-hmm. strategy that's like, we're going to have an assembly line. Like, we're changing the way that we're doing work, and we're going to do that slowly and incrementally and displace this. So it's this idea that I think most people miss, which is like, this point solution doesn't become this. There's no exactly. like, there's no exactly. way this becomes this. This actually goes out here and gets you further away from this. While yes. you think it's becoming this. So it's this idea that because you think you're doing this, you think you're doing this. This is a shame because now you're not doing anything here because you think you're doing this over here, and this isn't going to end up here. That's a hard one for folks, right? Like, they why can't you incrementally add AI to your existing tools? Like, oh, summarize my meetings and eventually have systemic change. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
So the way I put it, two things. One is that in my book, I had the opportunity. It's kind of funny how I ended up finding him. I was interviewing a VP of innovation at Georgia Pacific, of all places, where they, you know, they make toilet paper and like a third of all Amazon boxes. And he said, you got to talk to this guy on my team. It was a director of innovation at the time. And he said, oh yeah, I built Blockbuster on Demand for Blockbuster in 1995. And we piloted in Texas, and people loved it. We solved for the universal remote. We solved for, like, our UI was actually the Blockbuster store that you could click through sections and it would highlight comedy or like romance. Oh, or nice. When you selected it, it would turn into that, like, that he showed me the images of the screen where the, what it looks like in hotels now when you're clicking through, you know, the sort of horizontal bar. And then, and they also had a deal with Comcast for distribution. Like, they had thought through, I mean, they had enough that they could have launched a streaming service in 1995, but it got shut down because of it threatened 12% of late fees, right? 12 years before Netflix introduced streaming, they would have introduced streaming, right? So to your point, like, you could use, in that case, they could have tried to use the internet to drive more foot traffic and do things to get more people into the actual physical Blockbuster stores, because that was where they're making their money today. Or they could have used it to introduce streaming and like move into and lead. They actually were in the authority position and had the leverage and like everything to lead the streaming world. The same thing is what Hollywood faces today, which is you could use AI to try to cut costs and like go, you know, work out like, okay, now we can make films slightly more efficiently. And that means that we can make more movies, which means we can actually hire more people and keep more people employed on that. Great. You could also think a little bit more further out of, now we can introduce an entirely new form of education of entertainment that's more interactive, that where I can choose the ending of the story to some degree, or at least there's a choose your own adventure and there's three different options, or some new form, like you were saying about personalized presentations, mm-hmm. like personalized film. I think that there's, you know, so to your point, it's easy to want to say, no, let's keep doing what we're doing and let's keep making it more and more efficient endlessly. Mm-hmm. Bell Labs had a conversation in 1952 where they'd just been awarded the top industrial lab, and their president brought together all his leaders. And he said, okay, we just got named the top industrial lab. What are our top three inventions? And they said, well, the coaxial cable, the ability to thread six calls through a single line, and the transatlantic cable. And he said, great, when were those introduced? So they wrote down when they were introduced, which all was like 1940s. Remember, this was 1952. Introduced in the 40s, 30s, transatlantic cable was the 1800s. And they said, great, so when were they invented? And they assumed, oh, probably 5 to 10 years before introduction. But turns out all three of them were invented in the 1800s. So with that, and he said, he looked around, okay, so you're telling me our top three inventions that we've ever had as a lab were all invented before any of you were born, let alone worked here. Like, what in the world have you been doing? And he said, I'll tell you what you've been doing. We've had the wrong R&D strategy. Our R&D has not been actually research and development of new things. It's been research and development of improvements on the things we're already doing. And so we need to actually focus. And so to your point, Rob, what he said is we actually need to assume that the telephone system has gone down and it is irreparable. Like it's completely destroyed and we're building from scratch with all the technology and economic system and political, like regulatory environment, everything that we have today. What would we build now from scratch? And maybe we can bridge things over from what we have, but in the next year of doing that, they invented the basis of the touch-tone phone, voicemail, cellular tech. It was like a year of rapid invention, some of which took decades to come to fruition. Yeah. But that's a focused exercise. You're not going to stumble into that. Like that's a time focused exercise. And that's actually what I help a lot of organizations do, is to create that moment for themselves. Because it's not going to just naturally happen. Yeah. It has to be an inorganic exercise.
I like your analogy. I'm dating myself. I was there for that blockbuster moment. I was a consultant. I wasn't involved in it, but I was part of the opinion crowd to Blockbuster. I was a consultant. And it's a really good example, because that solution that you just mentioned was bottoms up. That was not top down. It wasn't the top saying, we need to build this thing. Okay. And when they came to the top, it was so clear that they had no idea. Blockbuster was a series of franchises, and each franchise had owners. And Blockbuster, their customer was the franchise owner, not the end person renting movies. Right. And they were like, how do we make money for our franchisees? Like, what you're talking about is going to war with our franchisees and taking revenue from them to go direct. They had to invent a system that was inclusive and gave life to those franchisee owners. They couldn't just compete with them, because it's not competing with themselves. It's not like the guy at the top can just say, oh, screw it, screw all of our franchisees, right? That's where they get their money. And you could say the business model was flawed from the beginning, because it shouldn't have been a franchise. Now, granted, lots of them were owned, and there's a lot of nuance to this. I'm totally oversimplifying. But it shows you that a bottom-up strategy without a top-down strategy,
you're destroyed.
You're going to end up creating something that doesn't fit the business model. And so you go, yeah, they had a solution, but it wasn't aligned with the overarching business model. So if you don't create a strategy at the top for how you're going to handle this, that's what you end up with. You end up with someone at the bottom coming up with it and it being wrong or off. You know, Xerox, like there's all these examples of
Kodak.
Bottom up. Yeah, Kodak. I love that one because a buddy of mine was there and brought in to solve that problem. And he would say, you had a bunch of chemists that basically built a company and ran a company around chemistry, trying to wrap their head around digital photography. And they're like, but I don't know how the chemicals are going to, how are we going to make film? I don't, like, they just could not wrap their head around it. And so I see what you're saying. But what does that look like? Like, why does that happen? Like, let's say they say, come on in, Brian, let's come up with a strategy. There's something missing. There's some way that you walk out of the room in a lot of these cases. They're still not aligned. Like, how do they get that alignment so that the bottom doesn't build something completely out of touch and the top isn't out of touch with what the bottom's building? I hate to call it bottom and top, but...
No, yeah. No, I completely understand the question. And what I do is I think there is a natural bifurcation where certain people are operations focused, certain people are not, are more future thinking. They see something about either where things are headed or could be headed, and they get really interested and maybe even obsessed with that. And so much so that they get bored and they struggle in like purely operational roles. So I think, first of all, just knowing that and from a talent perspective, make sure people are in the right roles. But what I do when I help organizations do this is I say, okay, first and foremost, like transformation of a culture of an organization is a tops-down exercise. Like it can be a groundswell where you could try and you could transform much of the organization, but if the top isn't bought in, if incentives aren't aligned, like it will ultimately, like when they say, you know, the falsely attributed culture eats strategy for breakfast. I always say the thing that bugs me about that is that you can design for culture and you could create a strategy to create the kind of culture you want to create. And that's something that Microsoft, right, from 2014 to right. You know, 10X, they didn't do that by just cutting costs, right? Like they had a new bold vision and they created a strategy for it. So when I come help organizations, I first of all say, we have to get out because we're going to create a vision and that's a vulnerable exercise and it requires you to take off your operational hat completely. So we're going to get out of the context. Like, let's get away from your offices, away from your computers and your phones where you can actually think, right? And without knowing all the fires that you need to put out. Because having a brainstorming meeting, like sandwiched in between all this operational work in a given day, you're not going to be able to show up with the right kind of brain power and energy and clarity of mind, right? Because in your mind is all those things you have to get to right after this meeting, right? Having an offsite is, I think, incredibly important if you're actually going to do this. And then at that offsite, having, first of all, introducing some of the ideas, right? Like how everyone is trapped in problem solving and that's the reason my company is called the Future Solving Company, because so many of us are trapped and we're trained. It's like, it's in our DNA. Like every conference you go to, start with what problem you want to solve. But problem solving is an elimination exercise. So it's curating and trimming the hedges you already have, the value you already have. Problem solving will help you make that incrementally better. But it will not, and problem solving has nothing to do with getting what you do want. So it just has to get rid of what you don't want. So future solving is envisioning and then solving for what you do want. So I introduce some of those ideas and that, you know, I make sure that we have enough of the right leadership team out there. Cohesion and alignment. And then I have them write down visions. Like what are three visions for the company and the market that you think are worth solving for on stickies, right? And then I introduce this thing called I call it the nindrant, because there's not a Latin equivalent of quadrant when you get up to nine. So nindrant it is. Where we talk about whether it's ambitious, not ambitious enough, bold and achievable, or too ambitious. And then the y-axis is achievable within my department. In other words, I don't need anyone to buy in. achievable within the organization with consensus. In other words, we have to collaborate across the org, or achievable in the industry with a coalition. In other words, it's bigger than our company. And it's really telling when you put that up on the board after they've written down their visions.
Oh, that's right.
And then you have them do an exercise of actually show and tell. Like, this is the vision I wrote down. I think this is bold and achievable. And I think it's achievable in the industry with a coalition. And this is the second one I did. And you can start, and they're not allowed to leave it there until everyone else agrees. And so that exercise alone is more vision in 1 hour and a half, or depending on how much time we have, 2 hours, more vision work than most exec teams do all year, because they usually are just receiving a scorecard, hearing, oh, I have to come up with this. Oh, I need a strategy for that. Okay. And it's usually reactive. Mm-hmm. And this gets out of that context. Then once they've done that, we let them vote with little sticky circles on which ones they want to solve for. And then we put that at the very top of the whiteboard and we say, okay, if this is a future we're solving for, what would have to be true for us to reach that future? So if you're Netflix and you said, or you're, you know, a studio and you said, we want to have, the future is we want to have an entertainment where the same movie can be viewed by everyone and it's personalized to them in such a way that it's just like blows their mind. Let's say that's the vision, right?
Exactly.
But what would have to be true for us to achieve that? And you start working backwards and say, okay, there might be 8 things that have to be true. And you list them and go, okay, if this were true, this were true, this were true, this were true. And this, think of like a decision map going, or decision tree going down. If these 8 things were true, would we have achieved the vision? And if the answer is yes, great. Then now we'll go to each of the 8 things one by one and say, for this one, what would have to be true, and document that. And you end up with this, I think, beautiful decision tree, that I call a reason tree, but where you're all the reasoning of all the things that would have to be true that you're thinking over. And then now your strategy is visible. So at that, when you leave that offsite, sure, you wouldn't have completed the whole thing, but you'd have enough of it that you can introduce it to the team members. You can say, this is where we got to. And you can collaborate on a visual strategy instead of sort of a abstract, I'm trying to describe what we talked about in the offsite, but I don't know if I remember everything. And right, which is kind of the status quo that we're at today.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to this book again. It's just because it's fresh. And I'm obsessed with this concept. So one of the things that he mentions is, which I think aligns exactly with your book and what you talk about. But what I like is he kind of takes this economics lens. You know, he really looks at it through like the economics viewpoint. Almost like how a CFO needs to look through this, right? And he talks about one of the biggest impacts, like systemic change with AI, is where you pull out the friction within organizations, not replace people. So in other words, you reduce friction, not replace jobs. Mm-hmm. And it's a super interesting, it's not like augment people, but it's very clear. It's much more precise. It's reduce friction, not replace jobs. And one of the things that's very clear when you start to like lay out where is the friction. So you draw a map of friction in the organization, right? And you go, okay, let's go find the friction and then let's apply solutions to get rid of it, right? And essentially, like, you're not going to see middle management doing that because they are the friction. At the end of the day, you're going to find out like, oh great, they are the friction and they're the ones most vulnerable, so they're the least likely to adopt, right? So you're like, okay, that's a problem. The people at the very bottom, they're suffering from the friction, so they're all about it, right? like, please, because we're gonna keep our jobs, right? The front line is the front line,
right?
And the people at the top, which are like the shareholders, right? They're gonna pound and demand that friction be reduced, because if you don't, that friction represents profit, right? And more shareholder value, right? So they're gonna be like demanding this, right? This compression. But one of the things that's talked about, the effect of this, is what you end up with is like less padding between the top and the very bottom, right? Like ultimately when you compress this, you get more transparency to the top. So when we talk about these like strategies and the fact that the senior management goes off and makes a strategy and the bottom is making their strategy. And then both of them do something and they just miss each other completely, right? You're like, well, if AI starts compressing the middle, what you're going to end up with is greater transparency at the top. They're going to have much more insight to what's really happening on the front line, because they're the middle, this buffer layer that tells them what they want to hear instead of what they need to hear is going to be gone. There's also a supposition in all of this that it's going to weed out the top managers and the top leaders that aren't good at their jobs. It'll expose them, right? Because now their decisions will get exposed. Instead of this buffering that happens, this will be exposed. But setting that aside, one of the ideas is, like, do you attack that first? In other words, as you think about your strategy, right, attack the friction and the highest friction first. And it's interesting to think, like, is it the friction for your customers to do business with you, or is it the friction for your frontline workers to get their jobs done? And I think that's a good question. I'd love to hear your opinions.
So two immediate thoughts on that. One is that I think that I like the idea, because what I love about it is that it's something that I talk about, which is designing for the systemic context of your organization so that people can show up and do their best work. And that's where I think my ideas and work overlap with that idea of eliminating friction that stops people from doing their best work or from achieving, you know, valuable outcomes for the organization and for customers and so on. Where I feel like there's a risk to that is that if you're searching for friction in the organization, from my time at many large organizations and working with many large organizations, I think there's an unlimited amount of friction. And so you could end up doing a ton of analysis and going, okay, here's the 15 different ways that there are friction. But it's a little bit like, it could be, I haven't read the book, but based off what you described to me, some of that friction might be like purely contextual, where you could look at that friction as a problem to eliminate, when instead the thing that I always recommend, which I'm going to need to read the book to, you know, get my own sense of what you shared. But my point of view is that the vision is the only, and this is something I'm actually working on researching and writing about right now. More to come on that in the future. And maybe I'll come back on the podcast in the future, talk about it. But is that vision is the only force with enough momentum to overcome organizational inertia, which I think is very simple. Talking about with friction. So I take, and maybe this is a very American mindset, but like one of the chapters in my book is called building a pilot purgatory steamroller, right? Of like, I don't want to go through with a fine tooth comb and figure out what every little problem is. I want to steamroll over the problems with vision that enrolls everyone in what we're doing, because they're so excited about they'll leave it to them to eliminate the friction in service of achieving a vision that they find purpose and excitement in. Would be my, like, more of leading with the, I guess, the carrot than not that the other approach is leading with a stick, but leading with that vision is, you know, when people are excited about and they feel passionate about what you're solving for, they find ways to eliminate the friction.
I like this. So I think of a very common UX paradigm here, design paradigm, which is in the early days and even continuing, when people talk about good UX, they tend to go in and look at an experience and look at the friction, right? And say, oh, people are confused here. People are confused. Oh, maybe if we make this font bigger, maybe if we have fewer steps in the process, then they'll buy it, right? So they start to look at the buying process, right? Like, whatever, buying a new car, right? And they eliminate, they have too many steps. And every time someone, we add a new step, then we lose, our conversion rates go down, right? It's sort of like why Amazon's site still looks exactly the same to most people, right? They don't even recognize the change, because you move a button just a centimeter over and all of a sudden sales go down. But they don't think about, if you supercharge them emotionally to want that car so freaking badly that they would literally climb a mountain to get it, right? Then yeah. that might be the easier job if you just emotionally connect with them on why buying that car is going to make them feel good and all their dreams will come true. Then it's kind of like if I give you $1 million to get through the process, you'll get through any process. And so we often in design forget that motivation overcomes friction in a lot of cases. And you got to work on both. You got to like, yes, reduce friction, but you can only get so far with friction. At some point, you got to go to the head of the journey and say like, but do you want that car? Right? If you don't want it, then the friction needs to be almost zero.
Right. At the point where you're purchasing something as big as a car, it's typically not going to be that there was an extra button you had to click. It's maybe you get to right. that speed, you go, you know what? Am I actually like, is this the right choice right now? Or, you know, for our family or for, you know, don't I need a 7-seater? This is more of a 5-seater. Maybe I should rethink that. Not because you felt too much friction in the process. Right. But, and I think, yeah. So I think that totally agree with you that it is, it's an organizational design principle, but that I think not just OD professionals should take accountability for, but that tech leaders, you know, business leaders and industry leaders need to be looking at and saying, what force of what we're moving toward? Because if all we're moving toward is like, hey, you know what? If everyone achieves what we're working out, we're setting out to do right now, we'll be 3% more efficient. Isn't that just great? Like, it's not that motivating. But if you said, but if we achieve what we're working on right now, like patients will like, we'll be able to like save lives or we'll be able to, if you're an education company, we'll be able to educate X% more people or, you know, like every industry, like even entertainment, like there's no industry where you can't have purpose in the root of what you're talking about with paired with a vision that enrolls people, that brings them along, that they feel like, wow, not only am I like, I love that I'm getting paid to do this work, but I also feel connected to what we're doing and why. And that means I'm going to go ahead and try to stop me from achieving this outcome.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. I think, you know, I'm sort of, you know, dwelling on this idea of, you know, vision being storytelling. And like you said, good stories are visions, like are tangible. They're, you can picture them, right? Yep. You like vision being like, you can visualize it. It's been described in that way. And that is so key that you spend the time to actually imagine for yourself what it is. And then that you communicate that down so that other people can share in that vision. There's the other end of that that is like the extreme opposite. Like if you don't do that, let's just go to like, let's say you do the opposite of that. Let's say you say, we don't have an AI vision. Our AI vision is no AI, right? And I'm not going to say that's wrong or right. For some companies, it might be right. But what I, and I'm sure this has happened to readers of your book. We've had several readers that will let us know they quit their job after reading the book. And I'm sure it's happened to you, as like I said, their comment was they read it and they were like, okay, this is what getting it looks like. Like this is organizations that get it. This is what they need to do. Right. And they read the whole thing and they're like, there's no freaking way my organization's going to do that. So I'm going to go somewhere that it can. So it led me to this place where like, as a leader, understanding this stuff and communicating it to your company, even if you never planned to implement one single thing, it's still critical that the people that follow you believe that you get it.
Right.
And that they're not in a rudderless ship, right? So there's some obligation for leaders to at least be literate, at the very least in the space, so that the people that follow them feel like they're not in an organization that's going to fall behind. And maybe it's wrong. Like maybe they won't fall behind, but the whole world is saying they will, right? There's all this, like you said, those influencers are out there saying, if you don't do this, you're going to die, you know? So, and they're believing them, right?
Yeah. Well, what you said touches on another thing that I've, another phrase that I've been kind of noodling on and fine tuning, which is that I believe that a shared vision for the future is the foundation of trust. So what I mean by that is if you, Rob, are working toward a future where there's going to be fewer, like no one in the world is going to be working and it's all robots and like, et cetera, et cetera. Let's say that's a few, I don't think that's where you're headed or what you believe we should do, but let's say that were your future that you wanted. And then I articulated a vision of a future where we're creating more jobs for people, right? And let's say that's the only difference. One person has a vision where it's almost no people, mostly robots, and people like, we got to do UBI because there's no work for them left. And a different vision is more people are employed than ever. And those are two different visions of the future. Like people will make job decisions of where they're going to work that will align to one of those two based on alignment with that vision. So that's obviously an extreme example to illustrate the point, but like the same is true for an organization. You either have no vision, which I'd say is the vast majority of organizations I've met where they say like, when you, I just come in and I ask like, what's your vision? Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're like, do you mean like our mission statement or like, what do you mean? And so, and then, or if you have a vision, it like you said, Rob, like it might not be clearly articulated, or maybe you articulated it to your leadership team, but it didn't trickle down to the point where frontline, like the way NASA, I forget which president it was, but there was a president who, when visiting NASA, asked a janitor what they did. And they said, I helped send people to the moon. Like, and that's true. Like if you looked at how long it would take for the trash to build up and no one to be able to work it in the NASA HQ, whichever HQ that was, maybe a few weeks to the point where it'd be a biohazard and then they'd all have to stop working. So like truly that janitor helped send people to the moon and they felt alignment in their role of how that was a part of that bigger systemic picture. And so I think that that's, for me, that energy of like, and I think that organizations with such an overt mission, like JPL getting the Mars rover like on Mars, or NASA, you know, in getting a man on the moon, or like there's that natural energy that clarity of vision just naturally creates. So I've been helping organizations figure out what's the version of that energy that can be harnessed and captured for you today in this context of sea change that we're all facing. Like that clarity of vision and communication, articulation of that vision. It's my hypothesis, and what I've been seeing in the research is that it's a force to be reckoned with, and there's not really a substitute that I've seen.
Well, if we look at like Joshua Ganz's model that Rob's talking about, right, and we assume that this technology will sort of flatten middle management. How do organizations craft a vision for that transitionary period, right? Like not, because it's not only going to affect middle management, like lots of people are going to transition in one way or another in their roles. Like how do companies put together a vision that gets people on board for something that is that drastic?
Well, I want to be careful not to on my end, not to, over respond to something I haven't read. So since I haven't read the book, I don't want to.
Right.
But what I will say is, from what I hear from you, what I understand is, if we believe that okay, there's a version of the future where the organization, like, and when you say the flattening, like, I think we're all deducing and deciding for ourselves what that would mean for the people that worked there to some degree. It's very easy to look at the current construct of what a firm is, of what an organization is, and say, we're going to take this exact construct of an organization and we're going to overlay AI, and then this is how it's going to transform.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost look at it more like what are all the different constructs that would make the most sense, that where you have social contracts between people leveraging systems and machines and processes to create value, and based off of like what we want to do, again, starting with vision. So if you have a strong vision for something you want to achieve, and then you work backwards and say, okay, the construct we actually need is a little bit more decent. Like Amazon's a great example where they're not so many different legal entities that are in all these different spaces, right? And so they've taken the concept of a firm, and then within those, it's a little bit more like the current general construct of a firm.
Yeah.
But I personally, I think it's another time, not only we're already, upheaving like business models. We're upheaving ways of working. We're upheaving, right? So why not upheave the construct of what a firm is and how it should be organized? Because I think that the underlying question under there, Josh, that you, from what you brought up, is where do I fit into your vision of the future? What does that mean?
Yeah.
For me?
Mm.
And if I don't see myself in the future, why am I going to help you build it? Right.
Mm-hmm. What I like about this is I think there is alignment with, like, if you look at the top and the bottom, who doesn't want to remove friction from their jobs? Who doesn't want their jobs to be easier? Like, if you just look at, you know, what drives people crazy in their work all day long, it is the friction of trying to get things done and having to go through these hoops that they've got to jump through, especially the front line, right? They're like, God, I just want to do my job, right? And I think if an organization aligns around, we're here to reduce friction. We're here to make your jobs easier, right? To do.
Right?
Yeah. That
spoken
feels
like through you, it's clear, by the way.
Yeah, like I get the land on the moon thing, right? And I think you need that too. Like, hey, and we'll land on the moon. Like, it's so we can land on the moon. But right. Some people just make pizza, right? They're not like, some people are like, yeah, but we just make pizza. Like, we're not feeding the world. We're not like changing the world. We're making pizza. And like, well, let's make better pizza. Let's reduce friction. Right. And it feels like a service leadership position. Like, we as leaders are using AI to service the front line and make life easier for them by reducing friction. But I do also agree with you to say, and here's our vision. Here's what we're going to do with that energy that we're going to free up. Now you're going to spend less time, less energy on bullshit.
Exactly.
And that's going to free you up to land on the moon so we can do something extraordinary together. And I do see both of those pieces. I like both of those pieces. So this is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not for everyone. Like, if you're, like you said, like if you're in the business of pizza, I would say that even like there's no business that you couldn't have a bold and achievable vision that would be creating new value within your space. So I think if you're a pizza chain, like for instance, being able to say, okay, you know, what is our underlying like need of a consumer? Okay, they as a consumer are, what are the times that they're buying pizza? They're buying them at when they're going to watch a football game. They're buying them when they're going to do a video game party. They're doing it on movie night. Like, right. There's these certain times that you're like, why don't we get a pizza? Right. So
yeah,
then it's like
what you don't feel like making dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. So what other things could be valuable for them in that moment that we could potentially commercialize and experiment, like do some A/B testing on?
Yeah.
That would make that an even better experience for them and profitable for us. Like, it's sure you're right. You're not saving the world, but you are like, that's you can still have a vision that creates new value and captures revenue.
And I love this. Like, okay, so I want to buy a pizza. How do we reduce the friction? What can AI do to reduce the friction for them to buy a pizza right now? Because why are they buying a pizza? To reduce friction, because they don't want to make dinner,
you know? Right.
Especially for 20 people. Like, I'm going to have 20 kids over for a birthday party and I don't want to make 20 hot dogs.
That's right. Well, and I think at that point it becomes a systemic thing, because what we don't want is 15 different pizza apps to have to download, like from all the different pizza companies.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe I don't want to have to send an alarm to have to order it 20 minutes before everyone arrives. Right. Like, I want to order it right now and just have
like,
it.
Tonight we're doing a movie night. Honestly, what it should be, and the funny thing is that the technology is already there, that I should be able to speak to my phone and just say, just the same way I set a reminder using like Apple Intelligence, you know, hold the side and say, I want a pizza. I want, you know, pizzas, enough pizzas to serve 20 people tonight. I think two of them are vegetarian, so make sure there's a vegetarian option, you know, but otherwise, you know, the general pizzas we usually order. Like,
yeah,
I shouldn't have to think about if it's Uber Eats or DoorDash. No. I should think about if it's Pizza Hut or Papa Murphy's or whom, right? It should just happen, right?
Yep. And it should not be transactional. It should be relationships. So you start like a month before and you're like, I want a pizza for 20 kids. Like, great. And then someone's sick. You're like 19 kids. You just send a text. That's it. Right. Got it. 19. Like, you don't have to go log into the app and find the order and then cancel the order and make a new order. Like, you just like, you just send a text. Like, oh, it looks like it's going to be 19. Oh, what they have is lice. Looks like it's going to be 10, you know? And like, oh, no problem.
Well, right. I mean, what you're talking about is where, like, the from a UX perspective, like, what percentage of the UX gets completely eliminated with AI, right? Where you don't have a UX. Like, when you make a purchase and I say I'm having a party and I, you know, I'm doing a Super Bowl party and I want enough food for this many people. It's maybe showing me a brief it's with of like, here's all the ingredients. But I, at that point, I'm not going through an Uber, didn't need to design a UX for me to do that.
No.
DoorDash, nor Safeway, nor Albert, wherever the store is that the
we want our kids to say, what's login mean?
Right. It's just, right. Exactly. Where
what's
you can literally
mean?
Just...
I don't get it. What's login mean?
That's a good point.
I can't
point.
Even explain like, it. I don't even know how to explain login to someone who's never logged in.
It's like, that's a great point. It's sort of like how, you know, I don't know if you've seen this joke that circulated where somebody saw a floppy disk and they told their parent like, oh my gosh, did you see someone 3D printed the save icon? You know, when they saw, they thought it was a 3D printed save icon. They didn't realize the floppy disk was a thing that the icon was based on, right? Thought of it the other way around. So I think, I imagine a future for sure, certainly, where people think it's super confusing that we used to download, you know, 100 different applications onto our phone. And
yeah, they'll
and
be like, what's download?
For every single one of them.
What's an app? Yeah. And you're like, email Brian, what's email? Like, you mean just tell him? Like, yeah, just tell him. We just used to say words like that. Like, you know, it's send him a telegram? What? Like, what do you want us to do? Like, we don't need to know any of this. We don't need to know what protocol is used to tell Brian. Like, this is gone. Right. This is completely erased in the future.
All that to say, circling back, I would say that I think that we are in an era. The thing is, like, everything we just described is a different version of the future than we're in today, but not one we're going to stumble into. And the ones that set a bold vision and that's bold and achievable for that future and actively solve for it are the ones who will define what the actual future looks like. People are looking out and going, oh, OpenAI is trying to do XYZ thing. And I don't know if I like that or what that would mean for us in society. It's like, well, what are you creating? Because they're actually like envisioning something and solving for it. And so if that's not the future you want to be in.
No.
Someone else is going to have to envision and solve for the future that you do want to be in.
Yeah, they're talking about a button in the pizza app that's like suggest an order, right? And we're like, no, there's no pizza app.
Well, and OpenAI is like, you know, there's no pizza app, right? Where you just you know, they want to be the new interface to everything. And and that's one version of the future that may manifest if you know, people say, like, you know, history is written by the winners. Same thing for the future. Like, the future is created by those who design and solve for it.
Yeah. Well, this is great. This is a great conversation. Thanks for coming on. We got to do this more often for sure.
All right. That sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thanks for hanging out with us on Invisible Machines. Remember to like, subscribe, and or follow us wherever you get your podcast media. Thanks to OneReach.ai for their support, and much gratitude to the many people working behind the scenes to make this podcast great. Until next time, Owagi.